And a very warm welcome to Thursday's Richie Allen Show. With me, Richie Allen. How are you? Hope all is well. It is the 28th of March, 2024. Tony Gosling, the former BBC journalist and the man behind The Knot, the BCFM politics show from Bristol. Tony is my guest. He'll join me a little bit later on this hour to be with you. Nice to be with you.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from the magnificent city of Salford.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And I think you know how to reach me by now. Use the app for the program, send a message, or go to richieallen.co.uk and use comment live, talk amongst yourselves there. And that's how it works. Yes, Easter Thursday, the long weekend, the bank holiday weekend, Carmageddon, they're calling it Carmageddon. Are you in a car? Are you in a car? Are you up to your neck in it? Have you not left yet? Are you leaving tomorrow for your half-term break? I'll tell you who is in a car on his way from York to Leeds. The one and only Mark Boyarski has arrived here in the UK. Bit of business, bit of pleasure, back in Blighty. And he's freezing his knackers off. Hello, Mark. He said he'd be listening in his car. How you doing, pal? Hope all is well. Stay in the left lane. Keep it 60. Get the cruise control on and relax. That's how to drive, says the non-driving expert at the BBG. Now, Scotland, we'll start with Scotland. Sure, we might as well, it's just as good as a place to start as any place at all. Scotland might become the first nation in the UK to provide terminally ill people with assistance to end their lives. If a bill that has been introduced at Holyrood is approved, I am now reading from the BBC News website, credit where credit is due. Now, supporters of the legislation say this will ease suffering. Opponents worry that some terminally ill people might feel under pressure to end their lives. Assisted dying for terminally ill adults, Scotland, is the title of the bill. It was drafted by Liam MacArthur. He's a Lib Dem member of the Scottish Parliament. It will be probably debated this coming autumn. It was published today and will potentially be voted on next year. And I have to agree with some of the opponents of the bill. They are saying today, why don't you call it what it is? It's assisted suicide. It's assisted suicide, not assisted dying. So I think we're going to spend a bit of time, not necessarily today or next week, but on the whole issue of assisted suicide. I think we're going to spend more and more time on that as time goes on. So it's interesting. The bill was published, debated this coming autumn, and possibly maybe become law in Scotland. Hate speech then, this coming Monday is April Fool's Day. Isn't that interesting? And legislation will be introduced this coming Monday in Scotland, and it will criminalise threatening or abusive behaviour which is attended to, and this is important, to stir up hatred based on certain characteristics including age, disability, sexual orientation and transgender identity. Criminalising abusive behaviour or threatening behaviour which is intended to stir up. You might have a go at somebody online, and the police and the director of public prosecutions might say, I'll tell you what your intention was. Now, your intention might have just been just to call somebody an arsehole, or just to say, look at the state of you. You can see your Adam's apple from the moon. You're a man. And that's because you're embroiled in an argument with a crazy tranny. They might say, well, you intended to stir up hatred against all the trannies in the world. Therefore, you can expect Plod to come knocking to check what was going on in your mind. Right? So these rules, mother of divine, these rules will apply in your private homes and online. You might get ratted out by your children. You might do, little bastards. Fears, there are fears that innocent people could end up on police databases with these new hate crime laws. And a woman called Susan Smith is a director at For Women Scotland, right? So she's a feminist, and obviously biological sex is very important to Susan, as it is to me. She says this law will be weaponized to settle scores. Of course it will, no doubt about it. She said it's very vague, as stirring up offences seems to be based on somebody's perception that somebody is being hateful towards them. And they can make a complaint, and the police are saying they will investigate it all. We'll look into it all, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. We'll look into everything. That fucker in Salford with a radio show, a pirate fucking internet radio show that nobody listens to. He said that I'm a man. Yes, tell us more. And I think he was stirring up hatred against all trans people. Now, it won't apply to me because I'm not in Scotland. And I don't think I'm bound by the jurisdiction of the Scottish police. Maybe I am. I don't know. So this goes live on Monday. It is a bit mad, isn't it? It's a bit mad. You know? Speaking of trans madness, we need a jingle. It's about time I introduced a few new jingles. We need a jingle, trans madness. This is not funny. There was a football team in Australia, excuse me, there was a women's football, that's soccer, tournament in Australia, and it was won by a women's team that would have made the East Germany female pole vault team of the early 1970s blush with embarrassment. Do you remember the East German women's pole vault team back in the early 70s? They had more muscles than Arnold Schwarzenegger and Hulk Hogan combined. Remember, they were roided up to the clitoris. They were steroided up to the clit, these women back in the 1970s. That was a bit too far, I apologise for that. Well, anyway, a women's team with five trannies won a tournament in Australia. They averaged each game they won by about 10-0. There were five trannies on the team, and one of them was 6'2", weighed about 15 stone, and broke a woman's leg in two places. Wonderful. Wonderful. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. The name of the team with the trans players, the team is called Flying Bats FC. They won the final 10-0, and one of the trans players scored a double hat-trick. A great big hairy woman with a big pair of... Right? 10-0. No, they won the final 4-0. They won the semi-final 10-0. And the women, some women were badly hurt by these men who basically claimed to be women. A 6'2", 14 stone player broke the leg of a 5'6", 9 stone woman in two places. But nothing to see here, lest you offend the LGBTQ plus community. What's going on? So they got a prize as well, the Flying Bats. They won $1,000 Australian. Australian dollars is like lira. It's worth about 50 quid, right? No, it's actually worth £514. One senior club official was quoted by the Australian Daily Telegraph as saying, "Look, our girls came here to play for fun, and they expect to play against women. They didn't sign up to be jumped on, to be headbutted, to be..." No, she didn't say that. But basically, they were kicked from pillar to post by a team with five trannies, including a 6'2", 14 stone player. "Disheartening," she said, did one of the managers. "Disheartening. I might slap on a frock, a syrup, a bit of lippy, call myself Raquel Allen, and sign up for Salford Red Devils ladies team. Why not?" Syrup is Cockney rhyming slang for wig, by the way. But I'm not sure what the rules are in rugby league. Maybe there are rules preventing men wearing wigs and playing with the women in the rugby league. I'm not sure. I'll have to check it out. I think people have tried to do that sort of thing before in any case. Let's talk about something far more serious. Although it is serious if you're a female athlete. Okay, according to the BBC, after months of warnings, a recent UN-backed report offered hard statistical evidence that the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza is turning into a man-made famine. Man-made. Now, the UN's most senior human rights official His name is Volker Turk. He said to the BBC, or he told the BBC today, that Israel bears significant blame and that there is a plausible case Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Here is Volker Turk. He is the UN's High Commissioner on Human Rights, so we should pay attention to what he says.
Look, when it comes to humanitarian assistance, let's be clear. Israel is an occupying power and has an obligation to provide humanitarian assistance. And if that humanitarian assistance does not come in the scale, speed and predictability that is required, yes, very serious questions are raised.
So let's get it very clear. Israel's to blame.
Israel is to blame in a significant way, yes.
You're aware, of course, that Israel says they're not to blame at all, that they give as much aid as is possible, that if anyone's to blame, it's the UN and it's particularly Hamas.
It is absolutely clear what happened on the 7th and the 8th of October by Hamas and some of the other armed groups is unconscionable. These are flagrant violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights. At the same time, the brutality of the attack by Israel and the method of warfare, it begs the question of the proportionality of the response.
You're saying questions. You say there's no doubt about Hamas. Are there any doubts about Israel?
You always have to prove the intent. But as I said, collective punishment, the collective punishment that was declared with the siege is indeed amounts to a war crime and it needs to be dealt as such.
The war crime needs to be dealt with as such. Francesca Albanese said as much yesterday, didn't she? The special rapporteur for Palestine, the UN special rapporteur. That was Volker Turk there. Okay, what about the Israeli response to it then? Well, the BBC is all over that. Have a listen to BBC reporter. Her name is Yuland Nell. Yuland Nell, what have the Israelis said?
Yeah, I mean, in Israel, the Human Rights Council is generally seen as a UN body that is biased against Israel, and Israeli officials are quite dismissive of the things that Mr. Turk has had to say.
So the Israelis said it's biased and we're dismissive.
Surprise, surprise!
Yeah, this has been going on for decades. The UN and human rights groups say Israel is murdering, killing, genociding, apartheiding. And Israel says, oh, you're all biased. We'll leave it at that then. It is coming up for 13 minutes past the hour. Tony Gosling will be on the Richie Allen Show. Not too far off now. Lots to, I think, explore with Tony. I'm sure he's got something to say about the absence of King Charles from an Easter service. Maundy. I didn't know anything about it. I'm not very religious, you see. Maundy. He sent his wife instead of him. She went to this, was it Worcester? Worcester or Gloucester? Worcester, wasn't it? To a church service at Worcester. And he didn't turn up. And, you know, a lot of chatter in internet circles about, I wonder just how unwell is this man? How unwell is his daughter-in-law? What's going on there? But lots to get into with Tony. We'll do that a little bit later on. In the meantime, I look forward to hearing from you. The sarcastic window cleaner, Richie, I have until Monday to insult everyone. Got it. It'll be an interesting weekend. That's right. If you're in Scotland, get your insults in now. Get them in now. Absolutely go for everybody. Leave no identity group unharmed. Go after them all. The non-binaries, the trannies, get stuck in on the internet. Because from Monday, you could end up having your collar felt. And be jeepers, you don't want to have your collar felt now, do you? Excellent point there. Paulie says, Richie, imagine being databased for one of these bogus trumped up hate crimes when we live in a country where unfettered members of society's upper echelons are free to prey on our most vulnerable people. If anyone belongs on an effing database, it's like your old pal David says, it's an inversion. It is, of course, an inversion. No group of people has done more harm, even though politicians didn't invent COVID and politicians didn't, you know, come up with the idea to lock down. Far more powerful people than politicians came up with those agendas, but they carried them out, didn't they? They took their orders and therefore they acted in a way that was gravely harmful for the populations. He's absolutely right, this Paulie. It's an inversion. Inversion. Ardell says, Richie, I would want to beat the shit out of the organisers of that tournament and the authorities. Why did the women play them, though? You know me. I like to challenge everybody, or try to challenge everybody. After the fact, the women that got the shit kicked out of them and legs broken by the great big tranny men, why did you play against them? Why not say, this is farcical? Look at the size of those bastards. I can see the bulge in that guy's trousers from 2 football fields away. That's not a woman. I came here to play against women. Don't play against them. Walk out. Say no. If that is a woman, I'm an elephant. Mike says, Richie, did you think it's strange, and maybe Tony might think it was strange, that the Kate Middleton video emerged as news was breaking of the attack in Moscow? Interesting that, Mike. I don't know. I'll certainly put it to Tony. You might need to drop me a reminder. I'm currently in the early stages of onset dementia, so I could forget it by 20 minutes from now. Messages to the website, to the app. I'm going to take a tune now, and then I'll have some water. When I come back, more news. More news. I'm going to talk about Thames water. A friend of mine said, it isn't Thames, Richie, which are THs. It's Thames. It is Thames Valley water or Thames water. All right, then. No need to be like that about it. Tom Petty, Running Down a Dream, is a great song. God be with Tom. Music from Tom Petty, that's Running Down a Dream. I think that's Full Moon Fever. I think it is. We'll go with Full Moon Fever. 20 minutes past 4 o'clock it is. It is Easter Thursday, the 28th of March, 2024. I'm a lapsed Catholic, just in case it isn't Easter Thursday. I think it is. Something about a donkey and Jesus on a donkey coming into... Yeah. Yeah. Coming into town, right, on a donkey, right? Yeah, I don't mean to be... Palm is a big deal today. Is it Palm? No, Palm Sunday was last Sunday, wasn't it? Was Palm Sunday last Sunday? I've forgotten all of this, you see, as the big dirty old lapsed Catholic that I am. To be sure. Messages to the website, to the app. Thank you for them. I'm trying to open the website right now. Apologies. Kay says, hello, Kay. Richie, long story short, I was conversing with a pallbearer who is employed by a local funeral director. Now, a local 57-year-old lady had died unexpectedly. I said to the pallbearer, I wonder if it was, and I made the action, the mime, of injecting my arm. The COVID jab, said he. Yes, said I. I don't think they were safe, he agreed. The pallbearer said, they are seeing a lot more excess deaths at the moment, especially in the young. It's a living nightmare, says Kay. Yes, no doubt. And I know, not only here in the UK and Ireland, but a number of people have gone to the trouble of contacting funeral services, funeral directors, companies, and asked them. And I think it's coming back unequivocally. It's coming back. Yes, we are burying a lot more young people or younger people than we would normally or ordinarily expect to be burying. No doubt about it, Kay. No doubt about it. Dan says, surely with the amount of nonsense that is chuntered out of the government, the hate speech bill could hopefully be used against them. I'm offended with the recent council tax increase, says Dan. You and me both, Dan. Problem is, pal, when they say things, anything in Parliament, in the House of Commons, they are covered by parliamentary privilege. They can say what they like. You can't sue them for anything they say in the chamber. They lose that shield, that cover, when they're in public or anywhere else, really. But they can say what they like under parliamentary privilege. That's exactly right. That's what it's called. Okay. Good evening to Paul. Thank you, Paul. He's mentioning Tom Petty and the Wilburys. Yes, of course, Tom Petty was in the Wilburys. This we do know. Thank you. Let's talk about Thames. Thames Valley water. Now, Thames, water wants to increase customers' bills. I can't even say it. Thames Valley Water wants to increase customers' bills by 40%.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Been a while, Amy. 40%. You what, mate? Yes, we want to increase the bills by 40%. Now, dear listener, I'm going to tell you a couple or three things. Do you like that? I'm channeling my inner Philly Leotardo. Look him up if you don't know who he is. I'm going to tell you a couple or three things. I want you to listen now. Listen, because this is one of them. I'm not smug at all. No, I'm not. I'm not that type of person. But I've been banging on about this throughout my entire radio career of over 25 years. Listen now. So the boss, Chris Weston of Thames Water, has told the BBC and Sky that customers' bills need to be increased by 40% by 2030 to pay for improvements. This is a private corporation now with shareholders and investors that is running the water, managing the water for 15 million homes. We want to charge the customers 40% more to pay for the upkeep of it. That's not how it works, Chris. We'll come back to that in a minute. He said, and I quote, "This is the price customers must pay for the investment in our infrastructure that is needed." The firm, according to the BBC, is in a race to find extra cash, wait for it, after its investors said they would not give the struggling water giant more money unless bills rise. Right? The regulator, Ofwat, must approve any price rises and has so far pushed back. Sources close to Ofwat, according to the BBC, says the regulator will stick to its guns and will not allow a rise in bills to address shareholder problems. You see, I've had arguments over the years with free market capitalist muppets who've come on this programme, and I have turned them inside out. I'm not being arrogant. I have told them why privatisation and why capitalism doesn't work for most people on this godforsaken planet. Doesn't work. And this situation with Thames Water is a wonderful example of it as to why the free market doesn't work. Wait for it. The current shareholders of Thames Water, which effectively owns the water supply for 15 million people, shareholders include domestic and foreign pension funds, as well as wealth funds from China, ding, 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 and Abu Dhabi. Yes, people in China, Abu Dhabi, pension funds, they own the water, serving 15 million households. Chris Weston said, now he's a relatively new CEO, so we can't lay the blame for what has gone on at Thames Water over the years squarely at his feet, but he's got to clean it up, right? He says it's a balancing act, you see. Ofwat even wants Thames Water to clean up its act, to stop polluting the water supply, to protect the environment and to improve customer service. Now, what does the government say? Well, Michael Gove, squirrely little Michael, the levelling up secretary, he said, quote, "The answer is not to hit consumers. Leadership of Thames Water has been a disgrace." He said successive management teams at Thames Water had taken advantage of customers by taking out profits and not investing. Ding, 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 ding. This is privatisation, you see. "We will spend as little as we can on making sure that it's safe and clean. And if we do that, we'll have loads of money. Fuck the consumers. Fuck the 15 million households." Yes. Labour, Muppets extraordinaire, just as bad as the Tories. Labour says the government weakened regulation, allowing Thames to get away with what Thames has gotten away with. Labour has never been, ever in its history, a socialist party. Therefore, they are not calling for the jailing of these bastards. A big adios to the Chinese and the Abu Dhabi and the pension funds. Fuck off now. We're taking back the water and we're not going to compensate you. You have made billions out of it over the years. So we're not going to pay you to take back what belongs to the people in the first place. That's what should happen. But Labour is saying, no, when we come into government, we'll just be harder on them. Don't swear again, Richie. All right, I will. It's a fuckfest, isn't it? Isn't it? What is going on in this world of ours? Chris Weston was on Sky News with Ian King, Business Live. Ian King. I think we might hear the presenter first, I think, speaking about the plan or the request to raise people's bills by 40%.
It's been widely reported that you're seeking bill increases of up to 40%. Is that a number you recognise?
Yeah.
So I don't think we have been at all secretive about that. The plans that we have put forward...
We've not been secretive about it. Well, that's okay then. That's okay. You've taken billions of pounds out of your ownership of the water. You've not repaired infrastructure. You've not upgraded and updated your hardware. You fucked everybody in the backside. And now you're saying, oh, well, we're not being secretive now about wanting a 40% rise, like.
Forward, which are very much in accordance with what customers are asking us to do, require an investment of around £20 billion in that 2025 to 2030 period. And that would result in a bill rise of around 40%. And we recognise that at this current moment in time, that could be very, very difficult for people. So at the same time,
you think,
we are looking at what we can do to protect those that are most vulnerable and can't afford that type of increase. And so we have a tariff that supports those people. There are currently about 320,000 customers on that tariff. And in the next 5-year period, we would expect that number to go up to nearly 500,000 customers being supported through that special tariff.
This guy should be in hiding, shouldn't he? I mean, realistically, I don't blame him for what's gone on at Thames Water, but the absolute goal of him to be fronting up on Sky News. Anyway, Ian?
You've made very clear there that bills need to rise to fund new investment, but that is not how most people are going to see it, is it? They will say this is a business that's been badly run in the past and that bill payers are going to be paying for the mistakes made by previous management.
I mean, I'm not going to comment on what has happened in the past. I'm new into this business and I am just focused on what we need to do.
You won't be long in it by the sounds of it.
Going forward. And it is very clear, listening to our customers, that what they value most is high quality, clean drinking water, and that we do all that we can to protect the environment. And those...
Yes, and the clean drinking water, the provision of this comes out of your profit, dickhead. Not out of charging customers an extra 40% on top of the outlandish water rates they already pay. You've got to take it out of your profit, numbnuts. That's how it should work, right? It was made clear to you when Maggie gave Thames Water and all these other companies, when she gave them the family jewels, run it like a business. You maintain it. You maintain it out of profits. You don't get to go and charge people an arm and a leg just to keep your pension funds and your pals in Abu Dhabi and China swimming in fucking money, right? Right?
Two things are primarily what is driving the investment that we are having to make in our network in that 5-year period. And we have to recognise that as we do that, we are dealing with climate change. I mean, we've seen in February a record fall in rain, and it was beyond anything that we have seen since records began. And
yeah, it's brilliant. You had a load of rain in February. It was fantastic. It's exactly what water companies want most of the time. Why were you not able to collect that rain, Chris? The guy who was interviewing him is Ian King. He's a business presenter. He's a money man. He's not really a journalist. I'd be jumping all over him. Are you honestly coming on my radio show and telling me you're complaining about having record rainfall in February? A water company that controls aquifers and that controls lakes and rivers and whatnot. Are you really telling me? But he doesn't. He lets them off the hook.
Our network is not designed to cope with that level of rainfall. And also population...
Because you didn't invest in it, dickhead. You didn't invest. You and your shareholders and your investors laughed all the way to the bank and you didn't upgrade your facilities. And now you want the poor people of Thames Valley, 15 million households, you want them to pay for it.
Growth, seeing a huge...
Let's get rid of him and his climate change. before I take to the streets with a pitchfork and a torch and encourage people to follow me down to the headquarters of Thames Valley. Unbelievable. This is going on all over the country, by the way. Climate change, eh? Fuck off, right? Eh? Do you hear what I said earlier on? He said Thames Water is planning to come up with a plan that is acceptable to investors who want higher returns and the regulator, which says it had to be fair. We'll come up with a plan that's fair and acceptable to our investors. And water, last time I looked, is an essential of life and should be a human right for every man, woman, child and every creature on this earth. Water is up there with oxygen and carbon dioxide. Wink, wink. Nothing is more important, right? Yes, I know. CO2, I know. You need carbon and oxygen for water, I know. These are human rights. And here you have a guy, relatively new, in charge of the water supply for 15 million homes. His company is polluting it, risking the lives of the consumers, saying that shareholders in China and Abu Dhabi and pension fund investors or managers, they won't invest. They've earned hundreds of millions, billions out of this company and others, but they will not invest unless we charge customers an extra 40%. Oh, good God. It is an inversion. Here's the former editor of the Financial Times. His name is Lionel Barber. He was on Times Radio today.
I never thought I'd say this on Times Radio.
He never thought he'd say what?
But I fear it may be time for nationalisation.
You're shitting me.
Really?
Hold the front page. XFT edit. It's I can being see held. It. Yeah. I'm going to be all over the Daily Mail tomorrow.
FT turns on capitalism.
No, I think Flix said it as well. I mean, the original plan, and by the way, 10, 12 years ago, I was sitting in the morning conference at the FT and said, what's this story about 500,000 litres of sewage pouring? Let's do a campaign. We did. We spent a year's reporting, and I had Water UK and the Thames Water all coming in complaining, saying, you know, what are you doing? This is not Patriot. You're the FT, you know. And the fact is the model was bust, and I remember having a conversation with Jeremy Hayward, then cabinet secretary, and saying, what is happening with the water companies? By the way, what do you think about privatisation? He won't, rest in peace, Jeremy Hayward, who was a fine civil servant, but he actually said the privatisation was a mistake, was badly done.
You think? I'll give you a quick giggle before we move on. I wanted to talk about same-sex marriage, but I don't have time today. It is 10 years since same-sex marriage was legalised and the first gay couples were married in civil ceremonies, excuse me. I was going to talk about it, but we'll leave it for later on. As for the sewage, water companies in England have faced a barrage of criticism because data is showing that raw sewage was discharged for more than 3.6 million hours into rivers and seas last year. Raw sewage discharged into rivers and seas last year for a total of 3.6 million hours. And that was a 100% increase on the previous 12 months. It is a depopulation agenda, isn't it? It's a death cult. We are being run by a death cult. LBC Radio's James O'Brien discussed the sewage. He was outraged, but he somehow managed to turn raw sewage into some sort of virtue signalling around illegal migration. This is quite funny, I think.
Raw sewage, which is shocking amounts of ordure coming out of people, being discharged into our rivers and our seas for 3.6 million hours.
He's not a great actor, is he?
It's pumping, it is discharging, it is not seeping or leaking or escaping, it is being deliberately and consciously pumped into our rivers and our seas.
He's right there, you know. It isn't an accident, this is not just poor management, they're deliberately doing this.
For 3.6 million hours.
You think he's angry? You should see Fergal Sharkey.
In a single year.
3.6 million hours in a single year, right? I can't even say it without laughing.
Here's another number. A record number of migrants have crossed the channel this year, piling further pressure.
Only O'Brien would turn sewage into virtue signalling about the poor migrants.
Pressure on Rishi Sunak to deliver on his Rwanda policy. So 338 human beings crossed the channel yesterday in seven boats, taking the total to 4,664. I know this sounds silly, but could you imagine...
Go on.
..how the Conservative Party... and their client journalists, the people who are still cheering for Boris Johnson, the people who told you that Brexit was a good idea, the people that gave Liz Truss a free pass into Parliament, and the people who are currently obsessing about small boats while failing to do anything...
Come on, get amateur idea, come on.
..meaningful about them. Could you imagine what the country's coverage would look like if it could be proved that the 4,664 human beings who made their way here in perilous circumstances yesterday...
4,600 people didn't come here yesterday, numbnuts. That's 2024. He's basically going to say, imagine if we could blame the migrants for the raw sewage. Then it would be in the news.
...were responsible for the amount of sewage being discharged into our waterways.
Wow, this is brilliant.
If you could somehow draw a causal link between the human beings in small boats and the 3.6 million hours in which raw, untreated sewage, literally shocking amounts of sewage, was being pumped into our waterways, I don't believe the story would ever be off the front pages.
Fantastic. Lovely opportunity to signal your virtue, your worth, your decency, your humanity for the poor migrants. If only they could find a way of blaming the migrants for the raw sewage, it would be on the front pages all the time and the water might be clean.
I don't think it would ever be off the lips of Rishi Sunak or Kemi Badenoch or Jonathan Gullis or whoever gets put up this week to embarrass themselves.
Fuck off.
Yes, exactly, Brian. Fuck off, James O'Brien. Hey, by the way, it's 20 minutes to the top of the hour. My spiritual guide, Jeanan Crowley, has been in touch with me. Yes, last Sunday was indeed Palm Sunday. Phew. And today is the Last Supper. Of course, today is the Last Supper, with tomorrow, of course, being Good Friday. And I remember going to church on Good Friday over the years to do the Stations of the Cross on Good Friday. Or maybe I'm misremembering this too. I could be. I am a serial misrememberer. Thank you for all your messages. I'm going to take another tune. When we come back from that, Tony Gosling, former BBC journalist, and of course... And of course, the presenter of the Not the BCFM Politics Show in Bristol. In Bristol, every Friday at 5 o'clock UK time, thisweek.org.uk. And this is George Thorogood and Bad to the Bone. Music from George Thorogood, that's Bad to the Bone, on the Richie Allen Show Thursday's programme, March 28th. Tony Gosling isn't standing by, he should be, but he isn't. We'll give him a couple of minutes. I'm sure he'll be along soon. It gives me a chance to read some more messages. Wayne says, Richie, this sounds like I made it up, but I didn't. My new council tax bill, I've worked out, will be 40% higher than the previous one. Now, it says online that the increases are not more than 6%, so I've no idea what's going on. The Labour Council leaflet is blaming increases on the government, but the policies that they are creating increases the cost of everything. They're all working together to implement, says Wayne. By law, Wayne, it shouldn't go up more than 5%. 5% is all they are allowed to increase it by. So I'd get on to them immediately and say, what the hell is going on? It could be a mistake, Wayne, but I wouldn't leave it go. Patricia says, my water supplier sent letters asking us all to pay a portion towards helping those bill payers who are struggling to pay. I replied, how dare you ask us, as bills are high enough. And I insisted they need to make all shareholders pay for the upkeep of the water and the infrastructure together with any repairs. That's Patricia. Yeah. Yeah. They have a cheek, don't they? Indeed, they have a cheek. They certainly do. Seamus says, Richie, After Monday in Scotland, those with dementia would be the group to target if you need a regular fix of bigotry or if you like to victimise people daily. People with dementia, they'll never have the marbles to get you to go to court, says Seamus. Maybe. Monday, Thursday. Thank you, dear listeners. Hi to Thomas, who says, Richie, when is your debate with the climate change believer? It is this coming Tuesday, Thomas. This coming Tuesday. Good evening to G-Man. Richie, I've always thought capitalism was 10% business and 90% putting other people out of business. That's a pretty good way of looking at it. Bridget's been in touch to say, I was chatting to an Irishman called Michael at Holyhead Port a couple of weeks ago, and he made me chuckle when he said, I don't think you're safe until you pass 60. Right. Yeah, that could be true also. Hi to Lewis, who says, the ordinary people are reaping the rewards of Thatcherism. It's socialism for them and capitalism for us, says Lewis. Rob says, clean drinking water. This dickhead wants to look at the bottom of my distiller after a few weeks. I know, Rob. Now, that's Thames water, right? We know I don't drink tap water. And neither does the missus. But there is a... It might be sediment. I don't know. But if you use a ceramic bowl or a ceramic jug and you fill it with tap water often enough, the sides of the ceramic bowl, the sides will develop an orange tint. That can't be good. But I'm told it is sediment. Don't worry about it. It's all right. Yeah. Richard says, Thames water sounds as bad as Welsh water. We had water flowing out of the ground 2 feet in the air, and it took them over a week to fix it. No doubt by the summer, they will tell us we're out of water. No doubt. Chris has been on to say, the gardener, if they put our water bill up by 40%, we would not be able to afford it. My conscience wouldn't let me put my prices up. My customers are mostly elderly people and they can't afford to pay anymore. We are struggling to keep our heads above water as it is. This is madness and I fear it's only going to get worse for most people. David Bramble has been in touch. Thank the Lord that O'Brien's oceanic verbal diarrhea only pollutes the airwaves rather than our waters. That was a wonderful bit of gymnastics, wasn't it, by O'Brien? To talk about sewage. 3.6 million hours last year of raw sewage going into the water and turning that into the poor migrants, you know? Only O'Brien. Hi to Ambrose, who's in Rhodes in Greece. He says, I have a friend who lives in Adelaide, Australia. His name is Ravi. This morning, he sent me a message telling me that the Australian Parliament has okayed a digital ID card. And this happened with the minimal of fanfare. Minimal mention in the Australian tabloids. Almost unbelievable. Something you should check out. Richie says, Ambrose is in Rhodes in Greece. Thank you, Ambrose. I will indeed check it out. I know that Tony Blair was trending on Twitter for some reason, but I didn't look into it. And Blair, of course, is a great proponent of these, say it for me, these digital ID cards, isn't he? Blair certainly is. Let's try Tony again. If he's not there, we're moving on. It isn't the first time Tony has done this. I put it down to eccentricity. I don't fall out with him. But if he's not there now, we're going to leave him. Because we can talk about other things. Doesn't look like he's going to be there. So we'll move on. All right. It's coming up for 9 minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show for Thursday, March 28th. I can give you a little bit of a heads up about what's happening in the next couple of days. So there will be, of course, a Papers podcast tomorrow. That's tomorrow. I will be on air with Sunday Morning Melodies on Easter Sunday morning. But then the Melodies programme is going to come off air for the month of April only. And it's coming back on Sunday, May 5th. It just needs a break, just for a few weeks, right? And I'll be taking a week's holiday in April in any case. But everything else goes on as normal. around the week's holiday, the usual Richie Allen shows and podcasts. So that's how it's going. Easter Monday is a bank holiday. If you know me long enough, you'll know I do not work on bank holidays. So I'll be chilling out here with a few beers. The Richie Allen show after today is back this coming Tuesday, and I will be debating a gentleman who has written a book about climate deniers. I think he's almost explicitly focusing on political climate deniers. I think he's a Democrat, and I think he's got a big problem with the Republican Party in the United States, and he reckons a lot of them have got ties to energy companies, oil, gas, whatever, coal, and therefore their opinions are bought. So when they say, these American politicians, that they do not believe in climate change, he says it's because they're bought and paid for. And he likes the term climate denier. He likes it. He's big into it. So therefore, we'll chat with him on Tuesday. It's going to be an extended conversation, meaning that we'll have a good hour 15, hour 30 minutes, and we will thrash it out. And we'll do that the way proper broadcasters should do it. There'll be no screaming and shouting. I'll have some questions for him. I'll have some points for him, some data, and I'll be asking him to explain it. And I'm sure he'll have some questions and he'll have some data and points for me, and I'll do my best to counter all of that. So it should be interesting this coming Tuesday. I'm delighted, really, because I've been asking the Green Lobby for years to send somebody to come on with me or to take part in a debate about anthropogenic, if I can say it, climate change, the rights and the wrongs of it. And I've never been able to, I've sadly never been able to secure a debate or an interview. But that was sadly. Gladly, I can tell you that Tony Gosling, the former BBC journalist and the man behind the Not the BCFM Politics show in Bristol Fridays at 5 o'clock, is now on the line. Good evening, Tony. How are you?
Yes, not too bad. Just arrived back in the car. Had a bit of an altercation in Costa, but let's not go into that.
Do, for Jesus' sake. You had an altercation
in
Costa.
Well, I had to go to the loo, basically, before I came to see you, and they said, I was not expecting to have a bloody, excuse my language, obstacle course to get into the toilet and out again, but it took me about 10 minutes to get into the loo in Costa. And so I was trying to use the loo. There's a code apparently now, so I couldn't get into the toilet. I said, I can't get into the toilet. So oh, we've got a thing on your receipt. And I said, well, my wife's left and I don't have a receipt. And so they gave me a receipt, and I spent a frantic couple of, I'm thinking to myself, look, you know, Richie's waiting. I'm punching these things into the keypad. Nothing's working. Eventually, they had to come and let me in a very grumpy fashion. So I would be boycotting Costa. It's just that, you know.
This is interesting. Anyway. So accessing the toilet, you have a QR code or a barcode on your receipt.
It's not a barcode. No, it's just a number. It's like, it was Q. I can tell you what it is for Chippenham if you want.
This is crazy.
Q. Anyway, I mean, it's a number and then a few, a letter and a few numbers. And it just didn't work at all, but anyway,
the toilet's reserved exclusively for Costa Coffee customers. That's crazy. Anyway, welcome back, pal. It's been more than a few weeks since you were on.
I was a customer, you know. Anyway, look, I mean, it's just really, it was fascistic. I felt these people are fascists.
Tony,
I'm not coming into this damn shop again because they're saying not only can, you know, there's some sort of rigmarole that it takes 10 minutes if you want to use the loo. So, no, I'm not going in there.
Good
again.
Man. I'm boycotting Costa with you. I don't drink coffee in any case. Look, we normally have spoken sooner. It's been more than a while since you were last on. I was intrigued when you sent me a WhatsApp the other day and said you'd like to get into one or two solutions. That's fantastic. Let's put a pin in that for 15 minutes and we will talk about solutions. But I've got to ask you about your old friend, King Charles the Third. You've got to pronounce the TH there. Don't call the monarch a turd, whatever you do. Listen, he didn't attend Maundy Thursday service in Worcester today. Didn't sound great in the message he put out. His daughter-in-law looked and sounded awful in the message she put out. Finally, after all the speculation about where was she, is there something going on, something maybe a bit, not sinister, but is there something going on within the corridors of Buckingham Palace and Kensington Palace that they do not want us to know about? Are these people possibly really unwell?
I think the Queen was a moderating influence on a lot of this stuff. I think she was a sort of a kind of normal person that found herself in the role. And I don't think she was in any way wicked or, you know, scheming or devious. And it suited the mood of the country after the Second World War. And that's why I think there were so many people lining the streets, etc., to see her coffin go to Windsor on the M4. I remember seeing the film. Lots and lots of people came out and they felt this is the end of an era. Well, they're right. So we've now got, who was it? Oh, this is a question for you, Richie. Do you know who it was that wrote the PR strategy for the royal family?
When? Now or previously?
Well, in the noughties.
Oh, having a clue, T. Having a clue now.
It's Jimmy Savile. Jimmy Savile.
Give over.
I'm not kidding you either. The PR strategy documents were handwritten by Jimmy Savile for the royal family, which Prince Charles, now King Charles, accepted and brought in to. So this is, I think, what we're dealing with when we're dealing with the royals. So it's all smoke and mirrors. A lot of it is smoke and mirrors. I find it really irritating and disgusting to hear the Queen, the Queen, the Queen, because this Camilla is completely like the opposite of the old Queen. She's, I would say, the witch queen. I would use that sort of expression to describe her. Now, you know, you've also heard me talking about Tim Cohen and his contention that Prince Charles, now King Charles, was the Antichrist. And this is through his biblical interpretation, his book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, which I wouldn't necessarily go along with. But
no,
it's,
of course,
you know,
not, but
666,
it's funny.
666 and the witch queen. Well, I mean, the thing is, with King Charles, Cohen goes into some fascinating details about him. One of the things is he is supposed to be of the line of David. He says he is. I don't think he probably is at all, but that's what he says. And this is something which is necessary for the Messiah. And so a kind of Jewish Messiah, I suppose. That's what we're talking about here. And then also he is has some sort of honorary position in the University of Cairo as a professor of Islam. So the idea is he's a sort of peacemaker. The
Charles does. Hang on. Charles has an honorary role as a Cairo uni, as some sort of, not lecturer, but professor of Islam. You're kidding.
Of Islam, yeah. Oh, I'm not kidding you, no. Anyway, look, I mean, this is all, if people are interested in following this up, Tim Cohen's website and his interviews explains it very in great detail. But, I mean, I just find it horrible when they talk about the Queen. I think of the Queen.
You love the Queen, Tony. I can't understand that. I can't. Look, just for balance, and I'm not going to say it again because I don't insult my guests. I couldn't stand the Queen. I'm not going to say it again, so on you go. Well, I'm an Irish Republican. How could I possibly stand? But just before you regale us with tales of the Queen's virtue, let me ask you this.
Well.
Let me ask you this.
I wouldn't go that far.
But Charles must be... Look, he's. I don't mean exterior. I mean, this is one of the ugliest characters of the 20th and 21st century. But it's not unreasonable to think he was mentored by, I mean, the IRA knew Mountbatten was a paedophile. He was a filthy child molester. And this guy hung around Charles, didn't he? So Charles might very well have been subjected to the most unimaginable horrors when he was a boy. Is that fair?
He was Charles's mentor, yeah. So obviously there are extreme concerns that Mountbatten was molesting him when he was a kid, sexually abusing him. So, you know, maybe initiating him into a certain, you know, elite cult type organisation, or, you know, at least into a mindset. But, I think Charles is just finds, I mean, one of the things you can definitely detect in his voice, at least for the last 4 or 5 years, is, since back to when he was still Prince, was he finds the whole sort of public engagement thing very tiresome. So he likes all of the prestige and the power, appointing judges, appointing military officers, appointing cabinet ministers, etc., that he gets through being king, but he finds the whole engaging with the public rather boring and tiresome. So this whole business of I've got cancer is extremely convenient for him. He just doesn't have to bother with all this stuff like dishing out money to the poor, things like that, which is what's happening today, Maundy Thursday, at Worcester Cathedral. So this is all extremely convenient. It's also a way of trying to garner sympathy, of course, if it's true. So I think I do feel within my rights. I don't like evilizing anybody, but I think I'm within my rights really to say I'm sceptical about almost everything that comes out of the palace. When it comes to Kate, you know, I have more sympathy for her. I think she's found herself in, you know, as a bit like Diana, marrying into this family, you know, this the firm, which is deeply dark and sinister. And I look at her, you know, just literally just reading her face. It's almost as if she's looking from side to side, wondering, God almighty, what they're going to throw at me next, you know. So she's done her job delivering the little ones. And I have quite a bit of sympathy for her being in that sort of situation.
But
so
she hung around.
I mean, I'm really not sure.
Sorry, T. She hung around. She was around William long enough before they became engaged. So she would have had a bit of an exclusive window onto that world, which we speculate about it, but she had a real glimpse at it. So why the hell did you accept his proposal and marry him then? I mean, if you spend, I know people who briefly met, and some people who, these are not journalists now, these are people who work in companies in London, who met the Duke of Edinburgh, Philip, and they'd never met a darker, more awful, more despicable, lack of courtesy, horrible human being. I mean, she must have known this just by being around them. Andrew, look at the state of these people, T. You don't need to be, well, look, you know, so why would you marry him then? I don't understand that.
How many women and men have married for money?
She has money,
and
though.
Prestige.
And her family prestige. Has money.
You know, and everything that goes with that, fame and fortune. This is, of course, it's going to be tempting, and also maybe William's personality has changed. I don't know. I just find it very difficult to see the family as a kind of collection of freaks, where they have to bring in people from outside, usually women, in order to sort of refresh the bloodline. And you know, they're quite good at conning people. I mean, obviously, King Charles is extremely good. He's conning the entire world into believing in net zero. And yeah. He's sitting in the background with his little company that runs the carbon credit system, and hopes that nobody notices. So, you know, that I think is, I just don't want to, you know, I do see them as still human beings, and maybe even redeemable, some of them.
Now, we'll leave it with a couple of comments. My great friend, Jean-Anne Crowley, she won't like this. Jean-Anne can sometimes be a bit of a West Brit. We reserve the term or the moniker West Brit for people who have a bit of sympathy with the old Queen, you know, Queen Elizabeth. So Jean-Anne would have a bit of sympathy with Queen Elizabeth. I've already said that I wouldn't. But she asks a good question. Would, because of the photographic evidence we have, and this is not now rampant anti-Semitism or anything else, but it's a fact that the Rothschilds have been intimately acquainted with the British royal family as much as any other royal family over the decades. So would the Rothschilds have had more influence over Charles than Savile, even though Savile was certainly in the inner circle? What about, we that famous photograph, Tony, haven't we? Of, yeah, he's dead now, your man, sticking the his finger into Charles's chest. So what about the Rothschild influence over the royal family?
Well, it's a good question. I think the elite have got different aspects to them. Obviously, royal power is very important, aristocratic power. And I think through the orders of knighthood of Europe, if you really want to look at the way that they organize, I think that's what they do. I mean, you look at the Knights of Malta, the Order of the Garter, the Teutonic Knights, the I think still existing system of the Holy Roman Empire and the Holy Roman Emperor. You know, amongst the aristocracy, this was traditionally the way that Europe was run. And you would be the Holy Roman Emperor, and you would then tell the other aristocrats around Europe who was going to be at war with whom, and fight like that. But so there's that side of things. There's also finance, obviously, is massively important. You know, we're now seeing the whole of Britain basically being brought to its knees by the Tory, Lib Dem, and now just the Tory successful attempt to just take away finance from local government. This, by the way, is exactly what the Poroshenko government did in Ukraine when they kicked out the pro-Russian people, is they stopped funding local government all around the regions in Ukraine. The same thing is happening in Britain. So you're seeing local authorities going bankrupt, services zero, So you're paying your council tax, but you're getting nothing from it. And you're having to pay for the services that you would say, for example, rubbish collection. They used to do in Bristol a free thing where they take bulk rubbish so you don't just dump it somewhere. Now, no, you've got to pay for it. So that I think is how the finance comes in. But when it comes to direct relationships, look at the Bullingdon Club with Boris Johnson and Nat Rothschild all sitting together in there, along with this now guy, I can't remember his name, he's the foreign minister of Poland. This is how they run things. They're all mates of mates, and they cook up their silly little schemes for more and more power, totally unaccountable and unelected. I mean, amazing to see Cameron now as foreign secretary.
I know, sitting in the House of Lords.
He's the guy. Yeah. Well, he's the guy behind the destruction of Libya, where you've now got slave markets, human slave markets in Libya. Well done, David. So you're our ambassador to the world.
When we say, Tony, when we say he's behind it, look, he was the prime minister of the day as Obama was the president. But really, they're carrying on somebody else's agenda, aren't they? But can I take you back to something? Because you said something very profound, not for the first time, on the Richie Allen show. You talked about them defunding local authorities, and you are right. But listening to Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner, and for our uneducated listeners, and we don't have too many of them, Starmer is the leader of the opposition and Rayner is the deputy leader of the opposition. Now, they said today, and I've friends who come on this programme, people you know very well, they said today that when they get in, they're basically going to open up a programme of devolution, the likes of which we've never seen before. They are going to give more authority, right?
Yeah, to local authorities. This is what Blair did.
Yes.
Blair did, when he came to power, almost unnoticed, was start this process of having the Welsh and the Scottish parliaments giving more and more power to them, getting them going. And maybe people have noticed, maybe they haven't, that the election system for the mayors began as a proper proportional system. Now it's being turned over to a first-past-the-post system to denude democracy. So these people are just playing games with us, really, as far as I can see. And the all of the tax take seems to be now going, almost all of it anyway, towards repaying debt. So you've just got a debt trap that these governments have been pushed into. And of course, this is all the Rothschilds, by the way, are intimately linked to Israel and the creation of the Balfour Declaration, the Zionist state, etc. So that gives a whole nother dimension to their influence. I think they are. I've done some stuff on Victor Rothschild, who's, I think, one of the most fascinating of all the Rothschilds, who was most definitely involved. He was around in the Second World War and died, I think it was 1990. Very, very influential on the Heath government, very influential on the Thatcher government, and also on the Wilson government. He was a Labour peer, and he was working for MI5, MI6, and also spying for the Russians. So the Rothschilds have been right at the centre of politics. My article I did when Margaret Thatcher died, which has got, quite a useful, for some people anyway, a timeline of privatisation, which goes through all of the privatisations that happened in the Thatcher era. And I call it Margaret Thatcher and the man in the shadows. Victor Rothschild was behind almost everything, the poll tax, by the way. So the family is immensely influential, both in financial circles with the, I imagine, you know, your Larry Finks, the Black Rocks and the Vanguards, very, very important. I mean, who are their main shareholders? Well, we're not allowed to know. It's a private business. So they're immensely politically and financially, and possibly, of course, with Israel and the Jewish state, spiritually influential. They seem to be everywhere.
They seem to be everywhere. Excellent work on Victor Rothschild. And he, if my memory serves, he was very, very influential in turning Edward Heath's head towards the European economic community in the early 70s, wasn't he? He was hugely. And I read some brilliant books over the years.
Through blackmail, yeah.
And I read some amazing books over, no doubt blackmail. I mean, it's fairly well established that Heath was a paedophile and that children were abused by Heath and others on his yacht, the Morning
Player. I would say, actually, just to put the record straight, I think it was young men. So we're talking about boys, really.
Boys.
Sort of 13, 14-year-olds. That's what I've heard from people that knew Heath directly.
And some of them were murdered, weren't they?
Possibly.
Some of these kids were murdered. I know, look, there's an old guest who used to come on the programme, Michael, who People take him with a pinch
Shrimpton.
Of salt. Yes, Shrimpton. People take him with a big pinch of salt. Half listeners would listen and say, Michael is a bullshitter. Everything he says is completely, you know. And then there were people who would say, well, he's a typical, if he did work in the spook circles, he's typical misdirection, misinformation. I always took him with a pinch of salt. But on Heath, he was so fluid in telling me what he knew about Heath. I thought, well, maybe there's something to it. And then I met some years ago a chap who said he would never come on any radio show. And he said a brother of his, he's convinced, was killed by protection agents around Edward Heath. I think you might know the man I'm talking about, who believes his brother was murdered. This guy now would be in his 50s now. His older brother was murdered on the Morning Cloud. That's how they keep them honest, Tony, isn't it? And can I just say this? So would Victor Rothschild, I'm going to ask you this then. I read an amazing book years ago called The Nazi Roots of the Brussels EU. I think you turned me onto it. And I interviewed And I interviewed the author of it. Wasn't the European Union basically a result of the failure of the biggest corporations and banks in the world to use Hitler to control Europe? Well, they would control Hitler. They wanted Hitler to succeed, didn't they? And unite Europe under Hitler. But then that they would use Hitler as a puppet to hoover up all the resources, all the money, all the real wealth. And the failure to do this, because the Nazis were defeated, this is where the European Union came out of. Is that fair to say? No doubt.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's Walter Funk, 1941. Who was the finance minister under Hitler. He may have just been the president of the Bundesbank. They came up with this plan to, basically it's a financial plan for occupied Europe. Once they got into the Low Countries and invaded France, etc., they're saying, well, we need to have a system for financial management. So this is where, in a way, it comes back to Blair and his setting up the Welsh and the Scottish parliaments. The idea is to regionalise the whole of Europe. The United Kingdom is no longer united. It's just separate regions of Brussels, and that we can have this kind of sham elections democracy. But actually, at the end of the day, the whole thing will be run by the European Commission, which is made up of essentially failed politicians, people that the public have booted out, or else so-called experts who are compliant. So the Fourth Reich, you know, is the easiest way to describe it, is a financial Reich, and it was set up in the 1950s and 1960s, and the political leadership of it was steered by the famous Bilderbergers, who I've looked at so closely, and that was set up by the Central Intelligence Agency, the War and Peace Study Group, as it was the Council on Foreign Relations in the States in World War II, so that the US could dominate the politics of Europe. And they've done that, I think, through the Bilderbergers. But, you know, Britain, if you look at what's happened here since the 1970s through the 80s, is simple, really. Thatcher's privatization, spearheaded by Victor Rothschild, and actually many of those share flotations of public assets like telecoms, etc., that took place in the 1980s, were actually run by the Rothschild the Rothschild Bank would actually manage those share flotations. So don't tell me they weren't intimately involved. Of course they were. And the idea here was that once Thatcher got rid of exchange controls, that is to say money could flow in and out of the country freely, these industries were privatized. And then you've got foreign entities of all sorts. Good God knows who it is. You know, in many cases, for example, it's the German railways, the French railways, the French EDF that control now and own much of our infrastructure. And chatting to a gas engineer last year down in Devon somewhere, he was saying, oh, well, it's we're all owned by China. So the Chinese and everybody, it's anybody around the world that wants to buy up British infrastructure can do so.
Look at Thames Water. Look at Thames Water today. Thames Water, owned by Abu Dhabi, owned by China, and it's owned by pension funds here in the UK, but also overseas. You're bang on. This is vital stuff. I'm only interrupting you because listeners want answers from you, goddammit.
That's bang on today, isn't
yes,
it?
You know, bang
so
on
they're
today.
Now saying that they're talking about nationalisation. So Starmer has promised the World Economic Forum he'll do no such thing. So don't think you're going to get any nationalisation under Labour. What they'll do, you know, is they'll just bump up the water bills in London. And that's then the shareholders will agree to refinance the company.
You are bang on.
Which at the moment isn't profitable. And that will be another way, a way out of it. But it'll be much, much cheaper and much more sensible and simpler for Britain, for British people, and more democratic if they were to just take it back into public ownership. All they do is wait till the franchise is finished or bankrupt anyway, and the government can legislate or just very, very simple for them to take it over. But of course, the banksters won't want that, and so they'll be making that very clear to their puppet politicians like Goldman Sachs, Rishi Sunak.
I have questions for you from our listeners. You're listening to Tony Gosling, former BBC journalist, author. Brilliant books. I will put links to them on the notes later on. And also broadcaster, the Not the BCFM Politics Show. It's excellent. Fridays at 5 o'clock. And he's also a Costa Coffee toilet rebel these days for his sins.
Deleting my Costa app as we speak.
As we speak. Now, before we talk about the attack in Moscow, because the listener has a question for you about this, about the attack in Moscow, I want to go back to, and you can be as brief as you like here, the devolution promises by the Labour Party to give more power, to cede power from government, as if they have any real power, but to cede the perceived government power and give it to local authorities. Great friends of mine believe the primary reason for this is because they want the local authorities, this is the global to local agenda, to run the climate change bullshit. Is that fair?
Okay, so it's fine to give power to local authorities when they're bankrupt because they can't do anything. That's, I think, what really is behind what your listener's saying there. They've got to the point now where the funding for local authorities is so inadequate, so pathetic, that almost whatever power you give to them is ineffective. Of course, there are a lot of them in Bristol. We've just had the implementation of one of these ridiculous, they put the planters across the road to stop you driving down the street. And of course, this climate agenda is also being used by Siemens, the Nazi electronics company, as it was in World War II, to put all these cameras up everywhere, to put everybody under surveillance. And I'm not sure if it's true. One of my guests was telling me recently that the cameras are also good for facial recognition too. So the idea is just get these cameras everywhere and turn everything into this massive surveillance state. So the whole climate business, I think, is perfect example of accelerationism. And this term, I think, more and more people are coming to understand how important accelerationism is. My old school friend, I told you, I think a couple of years ago when I first found out about it, Richie, Nick Land, who's now over in Shanghai, is talked of as the father of accelerationism. So this is a Nietzschean philosophical idea, what David Icke talks about, problem, reaction, solution. But it's actually a much sort of more four or five dimensional thing than that, where you have a problem, which is quite true. We do have warming around the world generally, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. But what they do is they exaggerate it and they come up with a solution which is going to make things worse. And that's what I see don't get bogged down and caught up in trying to argue about temperature going up and down, because it may be going up and down. It may not be mankind that's doing it. It certainly does seem to be rising at the moment in the Northern Hemisphere. And but what do you do about it? Well, the answer is you renationalize. You start to depend less on your private cars, and you have cheap or free public transport that people can use. When we were kids, we used to just go around on the train up to London, etc., or around on the buses for a few pennies, and everyone just did that because that was the easiest way and by far the cheapest way to get around. But they don't want to come up with solutions like that. They want to come up with market solutions which will allow the rich to get away, with paying no ULEZ because they've got a brand new Discovery, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, but I think I think you're both right and wrong there, if I may be so bold, my friend.
Of course.
I think you're right in what you said there about the rich. But this idea that they could make public transport free, this is planned. I mean, this is happening in France. It's happening in Germany. It's happening in southern France, where cities, entire cities, my missus being French is all over this, are declaring that either now or very soon, public transport will be completely free for everybody because they want to get cars off the road. And listen, you've given me the opportunity to flag up a debate. I'm debating a climate change evangelical this coming Tuesday. He's an American guy who hates climate deniers. I've been looking into this more than anything that I've ever looked into over the last 20 years. I believe, just to be very brief here, we are in an interglacial period at the moment. We are still in the most recent ice age. We're emerging from it. We're coming to the end of an 11,500-year cycle. It's probably going to get very cooler real soon. And there's nothing we can do, people, in terms of our CO2 output to drastically alter the climate or the temperature. I've just seen no evidence for it, T. And the solutions, like you've talked about so many years on your own shows and your books, the solutions give a real clue, don't they, as to what might be really going on here. I mean, the climate agenda is really about, as you said, surveillance, restriction on movement, restriction on what you can eat, what you can do, where you can travel, of course. And no, I don't buy it. And I'm an old, as you will, I'm not going to say it again, my listeners will kill me. You know my political background. I used to believe this stuff, this climate change stuff, Tony. I believed it. I swallowed all of this stuff back in the 90s.
I am an environmentalist. I still am. I very much care for the environment. I see it as, over Easter time, this is creation we're looking after here. It's very precious. And so let's not poop in our own backyards.
No, but hang on. Are you conflating two things? And you shouldn't, because you're too clever for that. You're conflating destroying the environment by polluting it, wrecking the oceans with plastic. These are disgusting things that corporations and globalists and whatnot have been doing for years. But that's got nothing to do with the claim that, you know, CO2, as generated by human existence, is changing the climate or warming the planet. Those are two different issues entirely, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. I mean, it's a conflation of the two. That's what they're trying to get away with.
Yeah.
I think, particularly in Britain, we've got a particular big responsibility because we were the first country on Earth to really go for mass urbanisation and the Industrial Revolution. And it wasn't that we went for it. It was the elite that went for it. And it was actually, I think, John Dee, if you go back that far in the Elizabethan era, that came up with the plan to build and expand a British empire around the world. I mean, he was basing it in a way on the old ancient Phoenician empire and Carthage, which was the big Phoenician port that they built up on the southern Mediterranean. And the basis of their power was, number one, is in secrecy. And that's, I think, what we managed to get away with quite a lot through Freemasonry and other sort of secret societies in the West, but also through very powerful naval power. So the Phoenicians on the Mediterranean, anybody that built a ship basically and started to sail around the Mediterranean, the Phoenicians would first of all be very friendly and nice to them, find out who they were, and then they would ram their ships and sink them. And that was in a way the sort of attitude of the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
In the 1700s, 1800s was the Navy, but they weren't just doing it in the Mediterranean. The Royal Navy were doing it in the whole world. So that's why I think in Britain we've got this big response, because we've got these massive cities like Manchester. I think Keir Starmer was in Birmingham or near Birmingham today, launching his local election manifesto. And these cities have just lost their purpose to be there. So we are the people who have got to come out with solutions and understand how is it that an industrial society comes out of being an industrial society and starts to become an easy place. There was an article in The Guardian last week talking about Britain's housing, saying it's the worst value anywhere developed world.
That's right.
And what you're going to find, of course, you're not going to find such good housing in many ways in the heart of Africa or whatever, but it's cheap. And what we're doing is we've got rubbish housing here in Britain, pretty awful housing, and the new houses that are being built are like little shoeboxes. It's massively, massively expensive. It's overpriced partly because of the migration and the massive demand that there is for new housing, but also simply because that's the way that people make money in Britain now. It's through monopolizing, controlling infrastructure and just jacking the price up because they can by price fixing. And so I think we've really got to find a way to redistribute somehow, to redistribute land. I mean, we've done it before in the past where people have had rents converted into their own ownership mortgages. In fact, the Irish did that in the 1800s with the Irish, the success of the Irish Land League. And in many ways, that was the reason why Britain finally had to give up Ireland. Okay, there was a lot of fighting involved, but you know, because we weren't actually squeezing so much rent out of the Irish, the English weren't anyway, the absentee landowners, then there was far more money was staying in Ireland. The people had a little bit more time. They had the energy and the wealth to get themselves a bit organized. I'm not saying they were wealthy, but they had particularly, they weren't having to it being this horrific rack renting situation where they were living in utter poverty and all of the money they produced was going back to England. So I think we need to look at the, you know, learn lessons from the Irish Land League of the 1880s. And what happened there was the people basically had were paying rent and they were given these very, very cheap interest government loans to buy their own plot. So you imagine if you're in a rented house or in a rented flat to buy your own place. And actually, you end up paying as interest on those loans far less than you would were on the old rents. So we need to find a way of just stop. And I think another good thing to do would be to just criminalise eviction. So to make sure that people don't feel that they're threatened to be forced out of their home in this current situation. We've got in Bristol, we've got a fourfold increase in the number of people living in vans over the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, this is, I mean, everybody is finding the same problem, but what we need to do, I think, is talk through and enact some of the solutions to the housing crisis, because it's at the root of the cost of living crisis.
Tony, these are some of the best.
People's income is going on mortgages and rent.
These are some of the best solutions I've heard for a long time. I've known you since my days in Spain. I never had you down as a fan of Charles Stewart Parnell. I can't believe it. I might just not do. I might not do another radio show ever again after this. I'll never wash my hands again, Tony. The great Tony Gosling extolling the virtues of Michael Davitt and Charles Stewart Parnell. Yes, absolutely. Fantastic, so wonderful. So how could it work then? Because you won't get a politician in this country to support it. I love the idea. Let's say that every family in this country. Let's put race and all of that bollocks to one side, excuse my language. Let's say that every family in this country should have by right, by human right, a certain amount of acres for themselves to own, to build on, and we'll help you do that. How would that work, T? Would it be like you said, the Land League back home, whereby, right, you will have to pay for it. We can't give it to you for nowt. But we'll do it through exceptionally low interest loans family, and maybe not even maybe your sons, maybe your daughters might pay back in the future. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's two sides to all of this. One is the obscene amount of land that some individual families and individuals own, and of course companies and corporations. That would be another thing. You could just simply make it unlawful for a company to own land. That land had to be owned by individuals. So what you do is you find all those really big estates like the Duke of Westminster, Duke of Buccleuch, and you target those. You would requisition them, maybe compensate them, maybe not, you know, really depends on the politics of the day, but you certainly have to have that debate and then redistribute some of that. Obviously a lot of it is, you know, up on a hill with a rock, and it's not a good place to live, but a very good model for that sort of land holding is the crofting system, where you have a bit of land on a hill and you also have a croft, which, by the way, a croft in Scotland, the lowland crofts, is probably the easiest thing to have a look at. But they're also Highland crofts. They are passed on through the family, so you can't buy and sell them. So you can't get a bank loan against your, you know, with your home as security, because you can't. The bank can't sell it. It can only go to people within your family, or be decided by the crofting committee. So this is a complete. This is an old-fashioned way of dealing with land. So it's not just a sort of commodity like a car or a plate or a screwdriver that you can buy and sell at will. But the other side of it is what I was saying just now, which is stopping evictions, just making sure that the people who are already in homes which are owned by the banks or by private landlords, that there is a transition between where they are, where, you know, them paying rent or mortgage or whatever it is they're paying to the situation where they own their own place through, as it was at Parnell organised. In fact, it was, you know what it was? Irish MPs held the balance of power at Westminster, and that's how they managed to squeeze this deal out of them. And there was horrific poverty over there as well. So the papers were going on and on about how terribly, poverty stricken, disease stricken Ireland was. And of course, we're getting to the same sort of thing with food banks in Britain now, you know, with so many people reliant, even people in work reliant on food banks. So these are the sorts of structural things, I think, particularly to do with land. And then, of course, you've got to address the money system, too, if you're going to make any real difference. So that is to say, you have to have a government controlled bank of some sort. So, I mean, obviously, this particular elected government would be useless. But to see banking as a utility, a public utility, and also to make sure that all taxes are on the wealthy. So things like bread don't get taxed. A small, modest car, maybe an older car, doesn't get taxed. The really expensive modern ones do. And we've seen now the implementation of these new clean air zone type charges, where the most expensive 50, 70, 80,000 pound cars aren't taxed at all. Whereas something that you've bought for 500-600 quid, that is taxed, and they use the this excuse of climate for that. So there are all sorts of changes, but I think money and land, if you can actually start addressing those two, then, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And it's, we could be, Tom, I think, you know, the first country maybe to come out of the industrial era and to start and maybe become a sort of semi-rural economy with people growing more of their own food, that sort of thing. In fact, in Bristol, I could announce, we've just had a fantastic victory with our allotment holders in Bristol. Thousands of them across the city were being told, no, you can't keep livestock. No, you can't have trees on your allotment. No, you can't have community groups using the allotment. All these sorts of horrific restrictions put in there by PricewaterhouseCoopers or KPMG trying to monetize the Bristol's allotments. And we just had the announcement today, no, that's not happening. They've completely kicked the whole thing back. So the allotment tiers have totally won. And everything is on hold now for another year or so, and they're going to have a proper look at it and a proper consultation.
The world we live in, Tony, doesn't belong to anybody. It belongs to nobody, and we're on it for a short time. Every human being, I've said this my entire life, I've only ever really had one political hero, and that's Salvador Allende. I loved him, even though he was dead before I was born. And later on, Chavez. This is beautiful. Every person, every family on this planet is entitled to some land, you know, to cultivate and to build a place to live on. I can't believe you brought up Parnell. You know, as a student of history myself, and as somebody who knows his own history, it was back on the 21st of October, 1879. I'm not going to lie. I'm not doing this from memory. I've just dragged this up now. They met in Castlebaron, Mayo. Charles Stuart Parnell stood up and he proclaimed that the Land League would bring about a reduction of rack rents to facilitate the obtaining of the ownership of the soil by the occupiers, and that this would be best attained by promoting organisation among the tenant farmers by defending those who may be threatened with eviction for refusing to pay unjust rents. And you can substitute the Irish tenant farmers of the late 19th century. You can substitute Irish tenant farmers with the people of Britain or the people of Ireland or the people of France. But will you ever get enough cooperation amongst people, do you think? Because I think people have never been so divided, identity, politics and everything else, as they are now. Because this would require huge mobilisation, wouldn't it, of people to come together?
Well, I don't know about people being divided, actually. I think people are becoming more united against what they can see as a kind of tyranny coming in. I mean, look at the two-party state that's supposedly giving us some sort of choice in the election. Oh, the other thing, of course, is the support for this genocide is universally bringing people together across the country. So, I mean, we've got, for example, an anti-apartheid Bristol apartheid free zone thing, which is kicking off in Bristol against the Israelis. They've got one in Cardiff as well. So ordinary people are coming together in a way to show their disgust for the way that, you know, the insulting way in which the country's being run. The Irish did, you're right, the Irish have sort of showed the way there. And I just think it's, you know, brilliant to see some of the results of that. I mean, if people haven't visited Ireland much, when I was over there, the country people had, there was lots of small holdings. It wasn't like the big farms in England. And the people have the time of day to spend to chat with you. And that, to me, is what it's all about. You see all these people in England just running around, trying desperately to pay all the bills, and then realizing sometimes they can't, trying to pay the childcare bills, having to weigh up, oh no, you know, am I going to be able to go to work to make the money to pay the rent? But then if I do that, then it's, you know, it's almost all my wages is going in other costs, in transport costs, in childcare costs. And this is a game they're playing with.
I
think we just have to tear it up and say, no, we're not having this game anymore. Everyone is in that one together. They do try and divide and rule. I realise that. But even that seems to be falling apart now when we look at the horrific, you know, the support for this mass murder in Gaza and for the Israelis. And even the Israelis are now calling the United Nations anti-Semitic. They're beyond a joke. So I think there is a raising of consciousness going on by the more extreme measures that our governments are taking against us. And of course, the corporations hanging around in the background who are really, I think, coming up with these policies. The government is just bending over and doing what they're told.
On the what's happening in Gaza, from the UK point of view, look, I have to be fair. I would ordinarily echo pretty much everything you said, but I've got to be fair, right? Maybe I'm wrong. Am I wrong? I would say I don't see a rise in anti-Semitism against Jewish people in the UK based on what's happening in Gaza. But I've had emails and messages from people who, you know, they say, Richie, I'm awake to what's going on. I don't support what's happening in Gaza. Most Jewish people don't. But there has been a rise in sluggishness in some places and outlandish behaviour towards Jewish people. Do you see or hear about any of that in Bristol or in London?
Well, I see no real anti-Semitism really much, not certainly having a go at people because they're Jewish. Many of the Jewish people, of course, like Alexei Sale and the rest, have been on the demonstrations, you know, against the Israelis. But what I do see is anti-Christian behaviour. I mean, we've got a pastor, Dia Moodley, in Bristol, whose Spirit of Life Church in Loch Lees is a Reformed Baptist church. He is a very gutsy guy. He's the sort of guy I've got him on my show this week talking about it. But he gets up on a little ladder and he talks about abortion. He talks about all these things. Actually, a lot of them are sort of Catholic style things that the Protestants seem to kind of brush under the carpet. He talks about genocide. He talks about the excesses of feminism. It's all sorts of contentious subjects that he gets his teeth into. But anyway, the fact is, last Thursday, he was pushed off of his ladder by some young women students from the university and you know, quite badly injured his hand. And they were just jeering at him. And this is at least what I've heard, although I think he may have been he was arrested and he was charged with saying that the Allah was a false god and you're not allowed to say that during Ramadan, according to the police. The university, he was outside the Bristol University up on Queen's Road. And so I see anti-Christianity. That's what I see. And that's nothing to do with the war necessarily, but it's being ignored. There's a lot of talk about Islamophobia, a lot of talk of anti-Semitism. I hear nothing about what's happened to Dia Moodley. And he was reported, by the way, his initial agreement that he supposedly had with the police, which the police now seem to have broken, that was reported on Fox News in the States. It was reported in the Daily Mail, all over the Christian press throughout the world. But it wasn't reported in Bristol, Richie. Nobody, none of these news outlets, ITV, BBC, Bristol 24/7, or the Bristol Post, none of them reported it at all.
I knew nothing about it until you mentioned it. I knew nothing of this, but I want to go back to something, though, to be fair now, T, right?
All right.
Not every Jewish person who says, I've been screamed at or threatened by somebody who's hyper, you know, wound up by what's going on in Gaza. Not every Jewish person who claims this is lying. I spoke to the historian Andrew Barr yesterday. Andrew's a top lad. He's Jewish. We talked about this. He's no fan of what's going on in Gaza. He talked about how, you know, the Zionists have for many times over the years have thrown Jews to the wolves, sacrificed Jews for their greater aims, you know, in expanding the state of Israel. Very good historian. Look, there is some stuff. It can't, because it's so polarised these days, everything is. We can't say that there's not some abuse coming the way of Jewish people. I'm not saying it's endemic or that it's institutional, but with everything that's going on, it's only fair to say there must be some, you know, they're not all lying to you.
No, look, I mean, the whole point is to divide the Islam and Judaism. At least that's the aim. The idea is to get a third world war started in the Middle East between Iran and Israel. And that, you know, that seems to be the motive. And this is one of the reasons the Israelis are just not interested in peace, is because they've got a war agenda and they intend to drag the Americans in on their side in that war if there's any problems, which there almost certainly would be for the existence of the Israeli state. So that's what they're after. And the point of all of that, I think you have to go back to, I mean, for me, the only way I can really rationalize it is going back to the Freemason, Scottish Rite Freemason, Grand Master Albert Pike, whose letter, allegedly anyway, I mean, this letter then disappeared apparently from the British Library, talks about, published in 1871, talks about three world wars. Well, if you look at the First World War, you can see the British kind of pushed the Ottomans out of the Holy Land. In the Second World War, there was the creation of the State of Israel, which, by the way, always was the object of the Knights Templar, who were created in medieval times by the Vatican, and to take over the real estate of the Holy Land and to turn it into hell. Now, his object in all of this, these three worlds, it was difficult to think in these long, you know, sort of hundreds of years time. But why not have a plan that lasts a long time, that, you know, various generations are trying to implement bit by bit? The whole point of it was to create such a horrific conflict, a third world war, based around religion in the Middle East. So particularly the clash of Islam and Israel, that everybody would be fed up with religion. Religion could be blamed for this massive world war, and that they would bring in their Luciferian agenda. That was his writings. That's what he talks about. So basically, we could have this nice Luciferian world where the ego, which is what Luciferian is really about, it's about people who think that they are gods, that the egotistical Luciferians can then sort of take over. We can sweep away all of this nonsense about God, the monotheistic faiths, Judaism, the Bible, all this stuff, and then we can take over the world. So it's a bit like Dr. No, world domination, same old dream. And that's what I see going on, and that's why I think you've got so much of a polarization between the Jews and the Muslims, is because they're getting quite close to finishing off their little Albert Pike plan from 1871.
I've got about 500 messages to read and I've only got 10 minutes to do it. So for today, and today only, we will part company. But before we do that, Tony's on air tomorrow at 5. He's written two brilliant books, The Siege of Heaven, How Breaking the Grip of Oligarchy Will Unleash the World's Human Potential, and The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group Origins. Everything we've been talking about today is referenced in these books, and I recommend you buy them strongly. So before I read these messages, last thing to say to you, Palace, happy Easter. Thanks for coming on today. It was an education as always, and I'm so made up that you know your Irish history, although I shouldn't be surprised.
There's a lot of, it's not in Scotland, the clearances too, that was in the 1880s as well. I mean, but if you're looking at Easter, this is, I think, a really good test. It's Passover this year, not every year, but this year, and I think next year and last year, you've got Ramadan falling in the same time as Passover and Easter. So let's look, this is the test for Ben-Gavir, for Smotrich, and for Netanyahu, is let's have a look. How really Old Testament are you? Just how really Ten Commandments are you? Just how much do you read the Bible? Do you believe the Bible? We will tell by your actions over this Easter, over this Passover. We will know by looking at the way you behave.
Tony, thanks again for today. Happy Easter, buddy. We'll speak real soon. Speak in April.
Thanks, Richie.
And I look forward to the programme tomorrow. I'll be listening tomorrow, 5 o'clock, Fridays, not at the BCFM Politics Show, thisweek.org.uk. Follow Tony Gosling on Twitter as well. There's only one Tony Gosling. That's real. There is only one, but there's only one Tony Gosling on Twitter. Check him out there. Thanks to him. Now then, to your messages. And they are, a lot of them came in. I couldn't stop to read them because time was pressing. Devolution, look at the dictionary definition. To make things worse, to de-evolve. It's not a good look for the average man, says Baron von Lotzov. Thank you so much for that. Hi to Kaz, who says, Richie, Z buses are free in Hereford City. You see, Tony? Absolutely, Kaz. That's coming, no doubt about it. Mac says it is currently about 3 degrees here near Loch Lomond. It's freezing. Where's all this warming? Where's all this warming? The boy cub says, regarding rent and mortgages, I'm still paying half my mortgage in Japan, despite being back in the old country. Interest rate on my Japanese mortgage is 0.3%. My missus' car loan, BMW official loan, is 1.9%. Her salary is double of what she'd get if she moved here, and she's a midwife. It sounds like Japan's the place to be. That's amazing. 0.3% on the mortgage. Of course, while we're Muslim bashing, and we're not really, nobody is Muslim bashing, not on this programme. I do accept that Christianity is in the crosshairs and has been for some time. I accept this. I'm an agnostic myself, but don't forget that there is no usury in banks in countries where the religion of Islam is prominent in politics, where there is a fusion of the religion and of the politic. Muslims don't believe in interest. And I'll say this, we, on British media particularly, particularly the conservative British media, most of what we hear about British Muslims is negative. I know a lot of Muslims. I've lived next door to Muslims, across the street from them. I travel in countries where there are many Muslims. And every single time I have been amazed by the generosity, by the humanity, by the gentleness and by the kindness of Muslims. Ask anybody who's travelled in Morocco how these people live. You know, communitarianism is a dirty word for us, because it is. Because the sort of communitarianism that Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates and Tony Blair want, it's tyranny, of course. But they practice community in many of these countries where Muslim is the predominant religion and Asian Muslims are basically the entire population. They practice it. You know, the Sharia nutjobs of the Wahhabists, they're in such a tiny minority, it's almost impossible for me to even find the words to describe it. I think most Muslims are like most Christians and most Jews. And by most Muslims and most Christians and most Jews, I mean those who actually read the scriptures of their religion. So Muslims who read the Quran, Christians who take their instruction from the Bible, and Jews who read the Torah. Those who are into it, those who are sincere, are about the best people you'll ever meet in your entire life, even if you don't share their religious views. And I do mean this. Some of the best people I've ever met in my life were Christians back home in Waterford. I used to meet people who were committed Christians. They would go to Mass regularly. They were sincere. These were the people volunteering to work with people with severe mental disabilities. You know, disabilities so terrible that people couldn't do anything without assistance. People not in control of their bodily functions. And I see these serene people, these great Irish people looking after them. And these were the Christians, those who really believed it, you know. That's how I see it, as an outsider to religion. Identity politics, he's right in what he says, Tony. But, and of course he never criticised Muslims, not on this programme and not today. There is a war on Christians. There is a war on Muslims and there is a war on Judaism. There is a war on faith. There is a war on spirituality. And I suppose one of their great weapons is somehow to convince each individual group that you are the biggest victim of them all. That's how I see it. I mean, we'll do a phone-in on this. We've got to do a phone-in on this. Because I know that half of you are screaming now saying that I'm talking bollocks. And, you know, you should really come on and tell me I'm talking bollocks, you know. No doubt. Bob says, Richie, the Tory MP presenting for GB News, says he was harassed in his surgery, that's his political surgery, his constituency office, by anti-genocide pro-Palestinian protesters. But he openly supports the genocide and has said he is totally against a ceasefire of any sort. And he cannot understand why he is being harassed. This is unbelievable. His wife is an MP herself. They both must be Zionists, says Bob. Bob, I know who you're referring to because I played the audio on the programme the other evening. It's an experienced Tory MP whose name is Mark or Martin or something like this. Yes, but to be fair to him, he didn't make a very big deal about being accosted by the pro-Palestinian people. He said they came to him under false pretenses. They booked the appointment at the surgery. They wanted to talk about something else completely. And then when they arrived, they came mob-handed, he said, and wanted to challenge him about his stance on Gaza. But I don't think he was, you know, demanding that they were, you know, he wasn't, because what's her name? Her name escapes me now. Sarah Khan, the social cohesion advisor. She said that this sort of harassment is dangerous and something needs to be done about it. But I don't think this Tory MP agrees with her. I don't think he wants, you know, a ring of steel around MPs or MPs' offices or whatnot. So, yeah, I hear you, but I'm not sure he's the right guy to reference, you know. Paul is in Northolt. He says, Richie, did you know or do you know that the Vatican created Islam and cultivated Muhammad, like the World Economic Forum, YGL, Young Global Leaders, is that right? They wanted to stop real Christianity in Africa, where it got out of hand, says Paul. Thank you, Paul. Ian says, Richie, most people are fundamentally decent, whether Muslim, Jew or Christian. That's fair enough as well, as that is right. Most agnostics or atheists are pretty decent as well, and they go about their lives trying not to be a burden on anybody else. I get it. He says it's the psychotic elite few that are the problem, as has always been the case. That's from Ian. Thank you, Ian. A lot of messages came in. I'm sorry I'm not going to get through all of them, but thank you for them. And thank you to Peter in Yorkshire. He's quick. It's Philip Davies in Shipley in Yorkshire. That's the MP. Thank you, Peter. Not Mark or Martin. Philip Davies, yes. He recanted a tale. He was in his constituency office and in came some very passionate anti-genocide people. But I don't think he was calling for some law. You know, he said he was quite capable of dealing with them. I think he was bemused by their conduct. He got them outside where he had a conversation with them, to his credit, even if he is a supporter of what Israel is doing. And I don't think that guys like Philip Davies can easily be accused of supporting what Israel is doing. A lot of these people, and I don't like any of them, they're towing the party line. That is all they're doing. It's cowardly, it's pathetic, it's hardly manly in any way. But it's pretty much what they're doing, towing the party line. He's probably a conservative friend of Israel, more than likely, so he can hardly come out and say, yeah, it is genocide, because before he knows it, he will have the whip removed and he can go and sit with Andrew Bridgen, or maybe go and sit with Jeremy Corbyn or Diane Abbott, maybe. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? So there you go. Right, there's just about enough time for me to repeat something I said earlier. The Easter plans. There will be a papers podcast tomorrow morning for Good Friday. The Sunday Morning Melodies Easter Sunday edition will be on at 10 o'clock this coming Sunday. Got to get my ducks in a row here. But then Sunday Morning Melodies is taking a break for a month. I deserve it. Because I've been working six days a week now, pretty much since I began the podcast, whereas I used to do 5 days a week. So I'm a bit knackered. So I'm going to give the melodies a break until May the 5th, which I think is the first Sunday in May. It will come back then because I love that show. I love it. And I can't wait for it every Sunday. It gives me great joy to do it. But I need a couple of days off, Saturday and Sunday. I'm taking a week off in April anyway, as I always do, to go and spend a bit of time by the seaside. So that's all going to work out quite nicely. The Richie Allen Show will return next Tuesday at 4 o'clock. The reason being, Easter Monday is a bank holiday and I plan to spend it getting pissed out of my brains. It's as simple as that. Okay, so there you are. In the meantime, all that is left for me to do is to thank, once again, the brilliant Tony Gosling. If you want to catch Tony, you'll find him at thisweek.org.uk. The Not the BCFM Politics Show will be live tomorrow at 5 o'clock. It is a 3-hour programme and it is excellently produced and presented. So check him out. Thank you, Tony, for coming on. And thank you, dear listener, as per usual, as for bloody usual, for all of your messages today. I really appreciate them. I'll take my leave of you now. Happy Easter. If I don't catch you tomorrow on the podcast, if I don't catch you on Sunday morning with the melodies, happy Easter. All of this talk of land leagues and everybody having their own home and the right to it. I've frantically searched for an appropriate song. I couldn't find one, so we've got to make do with this one then. Until the next time we speak from the BBG, happy Easter, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, bye.